Good afternoon. Please be seated, and if you're ready to proceed. This is Nunnery versus State.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chief Justice Douglas, members of the court. I'm Jonelle Thomas, and I'm pleased to appear today on behalf of the appellant Eugene Nunnery. I'm hoping to reserve 10 minutes of my time for rebuttal argument. This capital appeal presents a large number of issues. Unless the court has questions as to other areas, I would like to focus upon issues concerning the exclusion of mitigation evidence, jury instructions during the eligibility portion of the penalty phase, the untimely notice of evidence in aggravation, and jury selection issues. The first issue concerns the exclusion of mitigation evidence. Mr. Nunnery sought to introduce statements made by his cousin Willie to a defense investigator concerning Mr. Nunnery, both in utero and as an infant. Willie had lived with Mr. Nunnery's parents during the time that Bonita Nunnery was pregnant and with Eugene Nunnery as an infant. He told the investigator about the fact that Bonita Nunnery drank daily during the entire course of her pregnancy, and also told the investigator about the fact that Eugene Nunnery was very small, wrinkled, and jittery as an infant. This evidence was of crucial importance to establish the fact that Eugene suffered from fetal alcohol syndrome. Based upon the state's motion, the district court prohibited defense counsel from presenting this evidence. The district court did so for reasons concerning the credibility of the evidence, based upon the fact that Eugene's younger siblings did not know Willie. The district court did not believe that Willie's mother would have let him live in that environment. And an aunt who lived in the area but not in the same house did not testify to these same facts. She also noted that the prosecutor's argument that the testimony from incarcerated inmates is inherently suspect and highly suspect and impalpable. The district court's decision here was an abuse of discretion and deprived Mr. Nunnery of his constitutional right to present mitigation evidence. This right is well established by the United States Supreme Court under Lockett versus Ohio and Eddings versus Oklahoma. Any issues concerning Willie's credibility could have been explored on cross-examination, and the jury would properly be left to evaluate the worth of that evidence. And there is, of course, no authority holding that an incarcerated person is, their testimony is highly suspect and impalpable. We know that by the fact that the state routinely calls incarcerated persons to testify. And indeed, the state does not defend that rationale in its answering brief. Mr. Nunnery was highly prejudiced by the exclusion of this evidence. The district attorney argued during closing evidence that there was no evidence establishing that Bonita Nunnery drank while pregnant. Of course, there would have been this evidence had the state not had it excluded. The jury here did not find fetal alcohol syndrome, despite the significant medical testimony that was presented, and despite brain images showing significant damage to Mr. Nunnery's corpus callosum. A finding of fetal alcohol syndrome was especially important because it would have altered the balance of mitigating and aggravating evidence presented in this case and could have easily led to a finding that Mr. Nunnery was not eligible for the death penalty. And it also would have explained the outburst that Mr. Nunnery made at the end of the case during his statement of allocution, as it would have explained his impulsivity and lack of judgment. Related to the issue of the exclusion of mitigation evidence, are issues concerning the jury instructions that were given during the eligibility phase of the penalty hearing. The district court here had granted the defense motion to bifurcate the penalty hearing. There were two sets of instructions given. Mr. Nunnery offered two instructions explaining the role of mitigation and the fact that mitigators operated as factors against the death penalty. The state objected to those instructions, and the district court rejected those instructions, finding that the death penalty was not properly considered during the eligibility phase of the instruction, during the eligibility phase of the trial. The instructions offered by Mr. Nunnery were both legally correct, supported by ample authority from both this court and the United States Supreme Court, and were also fundamental in explaining to the jurors that mitigators did not operate against or excuse or necessarily be related to the underlying offense, but that the subject of mitigation was in fact the death penalty. Nowhere in the instructions given during the eligibility phase was the jury told that that was the role of the mitigation. And without this instruction, the jury could not properly make a decision as to the weighing of aggravation and mitigation. The next issue I'd like to discuss concerns the untimely notice of evidence in aggravation. As the court is aware, Mr. Nunnery had three cases in the system. The other two cases were initially believed to go prior to this case. This case, in fact, went first. At a hearing shortly before the start of trial, defense counsel notified the district court that the state had not filed a notice of evidence in aggravation and that the 15-day period had already expired. The state did not ever offer an explanation of good cause as to its failure to file that notice, other than to state that notices had been filed in the two other cases and essentially that confusion over the trial date warranted the state's failure to file the notice in this case. Submit that that explanation falls far short of what is required by this court in cases addressing filing requirements under Supreme Court Rule 250. Cases such as Marshall, Bennett, and Redeker all establish that a prosecutor's inadvertence is not sufficient cause and that a lack of prejudice would also not justify the untimely filing. In fact, here there is prejudice because a great risk aggravator was not included within the prior notices, and we've also set forth significant issues concerning the great risk aggravator. For that reason, the district court erred in allowing the state to present evidence during the penalty portion of the trial. The last two issues that I would like to discuss concern jury selection. The first is a Batson challenge involving a peremptory challenge against Mr. Bessie. The state used its first peremptory challenge against the only African-American juror on the panel of 32 potential jurors who remained following the cause challenges. Mr. Nunnery's trial counsel made a Batson objection to the challenge. The district court asked the state for its race-neutral reason for the strike. The state asserted that it exercised the challenge against Mr. Bessie because of his feelings about the death penalty. The district court then, instead of going to step three of the Batson analysis and determining the validity of that explanation, returned to step one and found that there was no pattern of peremptory strikes that was discriminatory. The state argues in its answering brief, without any case authority, that the use of a single peremptory challenge cannot form the basis for a Batson challenge. We cited case authority to the contrary, including the Ninth Circuit's decision in United States versus Collins, a 2009 decision. The state also claims that this court should give deference to the district court's decision that the peremptory challenge was made for race-neutral reasons. There are two problems with this analysis. First, because the district court never made any such finding, it's not entitled to any deference. The district court, as I mentioned, returned to step one of the analysis, never completed step three. The other problem is if you do a comparative juror analysis with Mr. Alejandro Vasquez, who served on the jury, it's clear that Mr. Vasquez should have been the subject of a peremptory rather than Mr. Bessie if willingness to impose the death penalty was in fact the basis for the strike. Mr. Bessie, although he had initially expressed some hesitancy on the death penalty during voir dire, had agreed that he would consider the death penalty and was willing to sign his name to a verdict form stating such. Mr. Vasquez, however, would not sign his name to a form as the foreperson in the event that death was imposed. Under these circumstances, it would be expected that Mr. Vasquez should have been the subject of the challenge. And finally, I would like to address the cause challenges. In particular, I'd like to focus upon potential juror, and I apologize, I'm going to get her name wrong here, Vita Chattaratana, if I may just refer to her by her first name, Vita. The record shows that she had not thought much about the death penalty or trials. This was a young woman who said that she felt uncomfortable about the death penalty, but she would consider it, and she would sign her name to a verdict form. The district court asked whether she had read anything or heard anything in history class or on television for which she thought the death penalty was appropriate. She responded no, and the district court summarily excused her for cause. The district court's decision to dismiss this juror for cause was erroneous and an abuse of discretion. The two-minute voir dire was insufficient to establish that she should be dismissed for cause.
Counsel, wasn't there some remarks in this case that she said she didn't want to decide in how someone else's life could result in, and no way she could ever reasonably consider the death penalty as a potential punishment?
She had initially said that, and then she had then clarified that if the law required her to consider death, she would. And she again stated that this was a subject matter that she had not given much thought to, that she had never paid much attention to. This is not someone with firmly entrenched, long-standing religious or conscientious beliefs against the death penalty. Rather, this is someone with no interest in the death penalty. And while she may have been properly subject to a peremptory strike, this fell far short of the standard for dismissing a juror under this court's decision in Leonard or the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Wainwright. Unless the court has other questions, I'd like to reserve.
Ms. Thomas, what about the use of PSI reports and penalty phases and maybe the conflict in our jurisprudence between Guy and Herman and all? What's your thoughts on that?
Certainly, I would urge this court to continue to follow Herman by finding that PSI reports are confidential. Their contents should not be disclosed. Certainly here, with the majority of the court having experience as trial judges knows the inherent problems with PSI reports. They're often submitted without any kind of verification as to the truth of the statements made in those reports. Particularly here, I think you see an example of that with Mr. Nunnery claiming that he made $10,000 a month as a drug dealer. Had there been any verification of that fact, it's highly likely it would have been discounted. Trial judges who routinely review PSI reports, parole board members who review PSI reports, understand the nature of those reports, the limitations, the caseloads of the people preparing those reports, the lack of verification, and give them the worth that they are due. But a lay juror not understanding the process of a PSI and pursuant to statute, they're confidential based upon factors such as that, I believe, they should not be disclosed during a capital
penalty. Aren't there some exceptions, though, to that confidentiality? I believe it's subsections 1 through 4. Can it be used by officers performing their official duties and all? I mean, is that an exception to it?
Certainly. And I think within that context, you have the parole board, you have probation officers, law enforcement personnel. But juries are not mentioned in there. And certainly, I think if the legislature had thought about this, certainly they've had the opportunity following Herman to revisit the issue. But there's no indication that the legislature ever intended that PSIs would be disclosed in that manner.
What if the defense counsel, what if the defense counsel doesn't object to the state presenting that evidence? What's your thoughts then?
In Herman, this court found it to be plain error. Here, there was no objection. There should have been an objection. I submit that it is plain error.
Thank you.
Is it significant that Herman was a non-capital case?
My recollection is that Herman started out as a capital case. The jury found, gave him life without, I could be confusing this. I'll look it up during the next argument. I don't think it matters. I think with a jury hearing the evidence, that it's got all those limitations, that the statute is the same. I don't think there should be a difference between capital and non-capital cases.
I looked at the record, and it looks like there was plenty of evidence of the fetal alcohol syndrome. What was so important about that incarcerated prisoner being able to give some more information about fetal alcohol? It seems like the other evidence was the best evidence, as far as I was concerned, as a former defense attorney.
I agree. And the other evidence was much stronger, and the fact that the jury here did not find fetal alcohol syndrome is another issue which we have raised, that they were clearly ignoring the bulk of the evidence in not doing so.
But what do you want? You wanted an investigator to testify that he went to a county jail in Los Angeles and talked to this prisoner, and the prisoner told the story of this guy being suffering from fetal alcohol syndrome, yet you've got expert testimony that said he had fetal alcohol syndrome.
Yeah, and the problem here is that the prosecutor argued to the jury there's no evidence of fetal alcohol syndrome. There's no evidence that his mother drank while pregnant. There's no evidence that he didn't develop this after the fact due to his own drug use and his own alcohol use.
There wasn't an objection saying, well, wait a minute, the prosecutor's all wet because so-and-so testified that there was, that the mother did drink when she was pregnant, that she was an alcoholic.
He wasn't, the testimony, the best evidence of that, Willie, who had personal observations of living in that home and seeing the mother drink, that evidence was never presented to the jury. That allowed the prosecutor to say there is no evidence of this. And the jury obviously believed that argument because it didn't find fetal alcohol syndrome. And I would direct your attention to Defense Exhibits XX and YY, which show the fiber tracking of an MRI and the extreme damage to the corpus callosum here. I think it's all relevant to the fact that, one, the instructions on mitigation were erroneous, but also the exclusion of that evidence and then the prosecutors taking advantage of the exclusion of that evidence.
But the family testified she was an alcoholic, and then Orison, who's a doctor, and Desi testified that the MRI showed that nunnery, it was consistent with fetal alcohol syndrome. I mean, that's good evidence. I mean, that was good mitigation.
And
much better than Willie, who's sitting in jail, through an investigator yet. It isn't even Willie coming forward. It's somebody saying that Willie said.
And certainly the jury could have taken that into consideration, and the weight could have been evaluated by the jury that it was coming secondhand, that there was other evidence in the case. But the jury should have been entitled to that evidence. And Mr. Nunnery was entitled to present mitigation evidence. Certainly hearsay is allowed in capital penalty hearings. It's routinely presented by the state. Here, they couldn't get Mr. Willie out of custody to bring him to trial, and they made the best effort they could to put this family history in front of the jury.
What about the Batson challenge, Mr. Bessie?
I have trouble with that one, and the reason I do is because when you use jury questionnaires and people give some of these answers that make them seem unfit as far as a prosecutor or a defense attorney, that they're almost married to those answers no matter how you try to rehabilitate them.
Certainly hear Mr. Bessie during, and it's common, jurors say something in a questionnaire, then they go to a voir dire, they learn, they're instructed by the district court, by the parties, and you get a more developed, more full answer. And I think it's necessary because we don't have individually sequestered voir dire, and so the questionnaires give you a fresh glance at the jurors. But I don't think this court has ever said that we're going to end the inquiry at the questionnaire without further voir dire. And when you look at the further voir dire here, what you find is that Mr. Bessie comes off as a much better juror than Mr. Vasquez.
But that's why we have peremptory challenges and we give eight in these capital cases, you know, that as a prosecutor, how could somebody like Mr. Stanton take a chance of leaving a juror like this on?
He did, in that he left Mr. Vasquez on, who shared all those same characteristics as Mr. Bessie. And it's unfortunate here that there's only one African-American on the panel of 32 judges, but extra caution needs to be given in that circumstance. Mr. Nunnery is a young African-American male. He deserves to have a chance. He's not guaranteed a chance of a jury of people of his race, but he deserves that opportunity. And here, when you evaluate those two jurors together and you look at the totality of the circumstances, it meant that the Batson inquiry wasn't met. Here, the problem is the district court didn't even make the right analysis, and so no deference is required because the district court didn't follow the Batson analysis. Thank you.
Good afternoon. David Stanton on behalf of the state. I'd like to begin by noting, Justice Cherry, in your question regarding the FAS, or the fetal alcohol evidence. In this case, the compelling evidence was Dr. Orse. When he put up that color slide of the difference between Mr. Nunnery's brain and a normal brain, as a trial lawyer, you couldn't have asked for any better evidence and a witness to proffer it. And not only did he opine that in his opinion there were several explanations for the damage reflected in the MRI, most not related to fetal alcohol, but one could be. And in his opinion, it was the best explanation. So not only did it come in the sense of the damage through the MRI, but in the testimony of this doctor, Dr. Orson, a neurosurgeon, he opined that it was the most likely cause of it compared to the others. In addition, my comment that there, I didn't argue, and it's somewhat taken out of context in the brief, about the incarcerated inmate and that there's no law regarding that. The entire context of the record in my comments to Judge Lohr was the only two times that this court has found highly suspect and impalatable evidence for purposes of the broad door that's open at a penalty phase is the testimony of incarcerated inmates. And as such, I thought that that was appropriately one of the factors for the court to consider in determining whether or not that evidence, once again, not offered by the percipient witness himself, but certainly through an investigator of the Special Public Defender's Office. Not that in and of itself that would have been a bar to the admission of the evidence, but certainly part of what the judge, I think, was required to analyze as to whether or not that was appropriate evidence. In addition to Dr. Orson, there were several other aspects of critical testimony of, indeed, the consumption of alcohol when Mr. Nunnery was in utero. That was not only testified to by Dr. Consora, but he testified from a medical degree of certainty that that was the etiology of the damage and the background of Mr. Nunnery. He had reviewed numerous medical records, social services records, because Mr. Nunnery, for a significant portion of his childhood and adolescent years, was a ward of the court in Los Angeles County. And in addition, not mentioned in the brief or in oral argument, was a relative who spoke in person at all three penalty hearings of Mr. Nunnery, an aunt who was related to Eugene Nunnery's father. And she stated that she had numerous contacts with the family telephonically, mostly. There were brief interactions at some family gatherings in Louisiana, but that she had always seen and heard her relative on Mr. Nunnery's side, Duke Nunnery, I believe was his nickname, and that his wife, Eugene's mother, were grossly intoxicated. And it was a combination of alcohol and or drugs. So there was direct evidence in that context. In addition, two witnesses that testified in this particular penalty hearing were Mr. Nunnery's brother and sister. And another compelling witness was Dana Nunnery, Eugene's sister, brought up in the same foster system as Mr. Nunnery. And she also testified at length, as did her brother, that indeed their mother, as they recalled it, they were very young at the time, but that their house was a mess. Their sanitary conditions were horrible. And that he remembers not only domestic violence, but as well as the consumption of alcohol and narcotics. So that evidence came in a number of different ways, and not just that the evidence was excluded in its entirety. the finding by the jury in the mitigation phase in the jury verdicts was they did not find mitigation evidence of fetal alcohol syndrome. And I would submit that based upon the record trial, it was more of a tactical error in how they presented it. That is, that they used Mr. Consora as indeed their overall expert, when in fact Mr. Orson by far was the most compelling witness. That finding was not based upon the exclusion of the evidence properly done by Judge Lohr, but more done by his trial strategy that did not succeed.
But all in all, they put on a lot of mitigation. I mean, I wish I had 14 witnesses when I tried some of these cases.
They did, Judge, and I can only tell you as a trial lawyer that when I walked out of that courtroom after the penalty phase with Dana Nunnery and Dr. Orson, I didn't think that there was a chance in the world that death was legitimately on the table. That was a compelling presentation. As far as explanation of Mr. Nunnery's allocution, I think that the argument, the nexus between the denial of the fetal alcohol evidence explaining away Mr. Nunnery's very direct allocution in this case is belied by the facts and the record. Mr. Nunnery is a very interesting individual. I think on the record, not only of this case, but of all three of the trials involving Mr. Nunnery. Mr. Nunnery was among a number of different things, one of which was he was brutally honest. He was a gentleman that did not take kindly to anybody trying to paint him in a particular way. And I think the allocution is not borne by fetal alcohol syndrome, of which no testimony, either in the first trial, the second, or the third, explains away his allocution. It was an insight from the man himself as to how he operated on the streets, a very blunt and brutal assessment of how he lived his life. As far as the jury instructions, I would submit that matter to our brief, and that the jury instructions were all appropriate. They were correct statements of the law and were given as they are in their entirety, properly advised this jury in the somewhat awkward situation of, as Judge Lohr ordered in this case, a bifurcated penalty phase. As far as the notice of evidence in this case, the record should be absolutely clear that something occurred early on in what I term Nunnery 1, which is, I, from my mind, wrapping around these cases, I always referred it in chronological order. The case before you now is Nunnery 3 in that chronological order. At the time, these all were tried. The same lawyers represented Mr. Nunnery, the special public defender with David Sheik and Yvette Meningo being lead counsel, and on most, I believe they had three attorneys representing Mr. Nunnery in these trials. The same three lawyers, when they went in front of these three different district courts, specifically requested that the trial order be the same as the chronological order of when the murders and these events took place. Now, the error that I made was, as a result of that, I filed both my notice of intent to seek death and the notice of evidence in support of the state seeking death in the penalty phase based upon what I perceived to be the order at the request of defense counsel. In retrospect, what I should have done is just done every aggravator in every case and noticed the evidence, whether or not it would have been admitted in the guilt phase or the penalty phase. I did so in order to keep what was mounting to be a considerable record and to keep reduce the likelihood of an improper aggravator being read either by the court clerk or some confusion in the paperwork that would be potentially submitted to a jury, things that I had observed in the past being problems. As such, that is the explanation, as I state on the record, for the delay. But I also notice, and was stated repeatedly in our brief, that if this notice is to have any meaning, and that it is not an absolute procedural requirement, as the case law indicates it is not, then the defense team of Mr. Nunnery had adequate notice of the evidence, because that notice had been provided in the two other cases months before this time and deadline had come up and had passed. And so I would simply submit that the authority cited by the appellant indeed stands for the proposition that there are circumstances with good cause would exist, but more importantly, the underlying relevance and necessity for this, as the Fondi Commission articulated back in the day when 250 was crafted, was that indeed capital defendants and their legal team should and must have adequate notice of the evidence coming forward. And that was absolutely done in this case. It doesn't and shouldn't matter whether the C number on the document that they had is the same as the trial went on, which I concede it was late by a couple of days. As far as the exercise of the peremptory challenge on Juror Bessie, I think the record speaks for itself. The compelling difference in counsel suggests that Vasquez, from the state's perspective, was a better juror than Bessie. I don't know how anybody can make that assessment when you select juries, but to the extent that you look at the record as to what both these prospective jurors told the court, but most importantly, what they said in their questionnaire, it has been my experience as a capital trial lawyer that the questionnaire, right or wrong, gives you some insight, at least when it asks about the death penalty questions, whether or not their feelings have been developed. Probably that's the most critical aspect, not so much what they say is their answer of do they believe in the death penalty or do they not, but some formulation that it has been debated in their mind as they come to a juror. And I know most of you are experienced trial judges, to say, as you, I'm sure you recall, jurors saying something to the effect, well, now that I'm sitting up here in this juror box, it's a lot different thinking about whether or not I can sit and vote in a capital case than me asking a questionnaire or engaging in some philosophical debate in a social environment. And that is indeed the distinction between Bessie and Vasquez as far as the state in exercising its peremptory challenge. Mr. Bessie, in his questionnaire, said that under no circumstances could he consider the death penalty as a sanction in a case. It was only under the voir dire process in court where that began to change. Unlike Mr. Vasquez, who indicated a reluctance to impose the death penalty in his jury questionnaire and reiterated, in essence, the same thing during voir dire. Yes, he could, I wouldn't want to, so on and so forth. From the state's perspective, when you look at those two jurors, one is qualitatively different than the other. That was the basis of the exercise of the peremptory challenge and the sole basis. As far as the juror referred to as Beta, and I would concur with counsel, I'd probably not do justice to the correct enunciation of her last name, but the record in reviewing hers is somewhat lost in the reality that took place. And I would submit that counsel argues that the court, Judge Lohr, failed to do a complete analysis of whether or not she could sit as a juror. Judge Lohr had repeatedly stated that the standard was substantially impaired. That was certainly in her mind and a standard that she knew. Beta, what's not reflected in the record was that this young woman was visibly shaking when she was answering these questions. It was something that I think, in very short order, Judge Lohr understood and knew that this was not something that this juror, based upon her answers and her repeated answers, that she could not impose it under any circumstances. As far as the PSI, I would submit that the Herman case in the decision about whether PSIs are admissible, either in a capital case or in some other criminal case, under Herman, what this court found was improper was the introduction as evidence of arrests, merely arrests with no disposition. And that clearly was not done in this particular case. What was admitted from the PSIs, and once again, it was timely objected to. The court inquired of counsel as to what was objectionable to the defense, and ultimately the PSI information, both about his sentencing and his performance on the boot camp, both of them PSI records or records from the Department of Parole and Probation, read that Mr. Nunnery's comments about his behavior and conduct, how he made his living, And counsel says, both in the brief and orally today, that, that there's no validity that Mr. Nunnery made, $10,000 selling drugs, when in fact the evidence supports that's precisely probably what he made on a basis selling the narcotics that he did, at the quantities that he did, and at the frequency that he did. Not only is it supported by the record, it also is supported by the quantity of narcotics that Mr. Nunnery had on him at the time of his arrest for that PSI, and certainly supported by his lifestyle that was observed in the search warrants of his residence with his girlfriend and the interviews of the surrounding people that were friends with Mr. Nunnery, to include his co-defendants. And thus, I would submit that the PSI of admitting his drug activity, how much he earned, his performance on boot camp is precisely the evidence that is relevant in a penalty proceeding. In fact, it is also, I would submit, even beyond, although it was not done in Mr. Nunnery's case, that when people express how they plan to change in the future, I think that's critically important evidence also from a previous PSI, because then it puts into context the sincerity and the efforts that they've made to that in that regard in future proceedings. So in the case of Mr. Nunnery, had he stated some indication of that, which he did not, it would have been extremely relevant for a jury to hear that as a sentencing in a previous occasion, he made the following representations to the court, and then, of course, in a subsequent capital proceeding, you can then evaluate Mr. Nunnery's body of work, if you will, his three murder cases, the attempts directly to kill 11 people at almost point-blank range. You could take that into consideration as to whether or not the evidence that they were hearing in a penalty phase, either in the form of an allocution or some other evidence, was sincere. And I think that's absolutely appropriate, and there is no more telling evidence in that regard.
Mr. Stanton, I believe in Herman, the court discussed confidentiality as far as a basis of not allowing the PSI to be or should not have been introduced into evidence. Do you think Herman needs to be clarified for some of the reasons you just set forth?
I do, to the extent that courts read Herman in that absolute terms. I would agree with that. And I think while there certainly are aspects of a PSI where privacy is a concern, and that aspects of a PSI would not be potentially admissible down the road, I think the concern, as I read the court in Herman, was the inference that it's some report prepared by a court, and that additional impromptu, that it has some increased weight to it because it went into a previous judicial proceedings, that when you then mention arrests, that somehow that indicates a negative disposition, when in fact none of those things occurred. And I think that was the greatest concern of this court regarding those portions of the PSI, that information is probably not proper in the context of just merely citing the arrests.
So what would you do as far as the PSI going into evidence or not going into evidence if it's got the arrest in there? Would you redact it?
Well, I think that's one of the things, Judge, that as a trial judge you can look at it depending on the nature. It either lends itself to redaction where maybe the jury at that point, with instructions of the court not to speculate if the redaction is too severe, or more what I've done on frequent occasion is a Q&A with the supervisor or writing parole officer and eliciting from them those areas and not touching the other areas that might be otherwise sensitive.
Well, there's nothing in Herman that would prevent you from doing that.
No, that's true. That's true.
Call the probation officer who wrote the report.
And that was done in this particular case, and it was redacted. The references to prior arrests in Nunnery's, in all three of his trials, were redacted. And then the subsequent report from his performance at boot camp and their conclusions about his behavior was admitted in its entirety, and there was no objection because none of that, I think, could reasonably be asserted was privileged.
So what would we be clarifying? What would you like us to clarify?
Well, I think
it sounds like you did it right.
I, from my experience, Judge, in the 8th Judicial District Court, there is some uncertainty, at least in some courts and in some trials, whether or not PSIs are viable or not. I think the general consensus is that arrests, as I read the understanding of most practitioners, is that arrests and certain other sensitive information that don't clearly lead to relevant penalty information is excluded. And the manner of which that's done, I've seen many different options.
Well, the sad part is because of lack of resources with the writers of these pre-sentence reports. They're not good like they used to be in the old days. When I was a baby public defender, the actual writer would be in court, and we could question him or her about the report. And now with the shortage of resources, especially in parole and probation, I worry about the reports as to their validity. But I don't see anything wrong with putting on witnesses to talk about areas of the report, but not putting the report into evidence.
But, Judge, one thing I would offer, at least in the 8th Judicial District Court that I've seen frequently, and that is defense attorneys, when they have their clients being sentenced, they routinely say, Judge, we object to the following provisions if there's any errors in them.
I wish more of them would do it.
I think that's part of the solution. Unless there's other questions,
Could you address the jury misconduct issue?
Oh, yes. I think the gravamen of that issue is that there was no indication by Ms. Jackson, one of the attorneys for the Special Public Defender's Office, in her recitation to the court of what occurred, that there was any discussion of the case or the substance of the testimony. The only thing that was related was some sense of exasperation about the length of another expert witness, in this case, Professor Jankowski, from the University of California systems. I would submit that the court made an appropriate finding and ruling that the evidence as was presented by the special public defender attorney, Ms. Jackson, did not reach the level of violating either of those jurors or any of those jurors' obligation and oath not to discuss the case.
The statement, though, was somewhat ambiguous. This guy's done too much stuff. I mean, it's not clear to me that they're referring to the witness as opposed to the defendant.
Yes, and I, you know, being the trial lawyer, when I read it, I thought they were assuming that Mr. Jankowski's testimony was too lengthy. And I would tend to agree with that. I think he made some salient, very relevant points, but the presentation was rather long. They were stuck with a travel schedule of Mr. Jankowski, and so I think they were trying to do more with what the time they had on the case. And I think that was, as I read it from sitting in the front row, that was my assessment of what the jurors were talking about. And I don't think that they were assessing any of the quality of the presentation of the defense. It was a significantly well-prepared and very well-done presentation.
Did the defense attorney ask, or did the special public defender ask to have the jurors questioned?
You know, Judge, I can't recall. I believe there was some discussion as to whether or not the jurors were to be polled, but I'm not sure whether or not Ms. Jackson could identify which jurors were involved. And thus becomes the problem of, do you bring up a subject matter that other jurors haven't even discussed or weren't involved in? That's the best of my recollection.
Mr. Stanton, Nunnery argues one of the jury instructions not given here was that aggravators had to be determined to be outweighed by mitigators beyond a reasonable doubt. This past summer, the Ninth Circuit in Harrison versus Gillespie commented about some conflict in our jurisprudence with respect to that subject. Is there such a conflict, and if so, what is the state's point of view with respect to addressing those conflicts?
Number one, Judge, I don't think there is a conflict, and I think this court's last ruling in what is commonly referred in the briefing of this matter as McConnell 3 is a correct and precise analysis of the law, not only in the state of Nevada, but in the federal jurisdiction as well, because since Ring and Apprendi, there's been a decade of jurisprudence of a number of different states and federal jurisdiction that have, in part or very similar, a weighing process. And not one of those cases has ever indicated that, indeed, the assessment of McConnell is indeed incorrect. And I would suggest that if that were not the case, and it would be certainly a compelling aspect of capital litigation to require that burden of proof being asserted, that you would have seen it articulated and explained in great detail by courts because of its significance. In our brief at page 24, since you mentioned the Ninth Circuit, there is a case out of the Ninth Circuit, Mitchell, and the quote that we put in our brief is, once again, the Ninth Circuit speaking, how can beyond a reasonable doubt be sensibly superimposed upon this process, that is, the weighing process? And I would submit that that's an absolute correct statement of kind of the bottom line here, that it is not a process that can readily be ascertained by that proof, since there's no finding of any fact and that there's no element for the state to prove or disprove. And thus, it's attaching a evidentiary standard to an analysis that is not does not lend itself to that process.
So perhaps the conflicting observations are occurring at the Ninth Circuit between Harrison and Mitchell.
I'm sorry, could you repeat that again?
Perhaps the conflicting observations are being made at the Ninth Circuit by Harrison and Mitchell.
And I would think that's true, especially in the Harrison, since they've ordered rehearing on that on bonk, that might be an indication that indeed the Ninth Circuit has maybe looked in the mirror in that regard. The one final thing I would mention, and that is in the argument about the aggravator of risk of harm to more than one person, the appellate brief states that Mr. Nunnery only acted in discharging his weapon so that it would not cause the risk of harm. In essence, they argue that the co-defendants were the ones that were shooting up this neighborhood. In fact, the evidence is directly contradictory to that fact. The only reasonable argument I think that could be made in that regard, and it wasn't made by defense counsel during the penalty phase, Mr. Nunnery, after the first victim, there was five Hispanic men that were approached by four defendants. And the first individual, when the command after all four brandished guns was dinero or give me your effing money, one of these five individuals ran. As a result of that behavior, the forensic evidence indicates conclusively that at least two guns were fired at him as he was fleeing, a .45 caliber semi-automatic and a 9mm semi-automatic. That's evidenced not only by the intact bullets, at least those that were, but also the expended cartridges at the scene in those calibers. It was conclusively proven that Mr. Nunnery was the author of the 9mm rounds. And his rounds not only were expended in the direction of that fleeing individual, but then he turned and proceeded and executed Saul Nunez, firing forensically, the evidence established, not only into his head, but his upper body. Now, one could argue that, and as the witnesses described Mr. Nunnery coming back the second time over Mr. Nunez after shooting him in the head and dropping him to the ground, that those shots from his standing position down did not exhibit a great risk of harm to more than one person. Mr. Nunnery, by the evidence, then went to a second individual who was playing dead and shot him through his baseball cap right behind his left ear and dug a trough that's part of the record of his injuries. That's Victor Ambrose. And thus, one could then argue that that round by Mr. Nunnery was not the one that shot up the apartment building and shots that were fired and never recovered out into a very busy street and an occupied bus stop in that street. Thus, Mr. Nunnery, in his statement, says after this shooting took place, he checked the weapons of all his co-defendants to see how many shots were fired. One, the evidence strongly suggests, was a revolver, and thus that expended cartridges would not have been found at the scene. And he concluded and counted the number of rounds that he shot, which was in excess of nine, and they do not account for the execution-style shots. Thus, I would submit that the evidence is replete and significant in establishing the risk of harm, not only by his own conduct with his 9mm, but by the Tyson liability of him acting in concert with his confederates. And thank you very much.
Mr. Thomas?
Before you get into your rebuttal, would you talk about the jury misconduct?
Certainly. Your Honor, we asked for an evidentiary hearing in the motion for mistrial. Submit that the district court was obligated to hold a hearing to find out the extent of the misconduct. Certainly, Ms. Jackson was not following the jurors around trying to get evidence. She overheard something. She brought it to the district court's attention. There should have been an inquiry as asked by the defense counsel, because there wasn't a full record, was never developed, and we'll never know the extent of the discussions. But I submit that there was enough of a discussion that there should have been a hearing. And I'd like to start with the fetal alcohol evidence. And particularly at page 64 of the opening brief, I cite and quote from the prosecutor's closing argument found at 9 Record on Appeal, page 2148. As he begins, "What evidence is there to suggest that at the time Eugene Nunnery's mother was pregnant, she ingested alcohol? I would submit there's no evidence other than what they want to infer to you that indeed the mother was an alcoholic and a drug addict." In the district court, in front of the jury, the prosecutor denied the existence of fetal alcohol based upon the fact that there were no observations of the mother drinking while pregnant, and also significant is the state of Eugene Nunnery as an infant, and there was no other testimony on that point. Based upon the fact that the prosecutor repeatedly denied the existence of fetal alcohol to the jury, and the fact that the jury did not find fetal alcohol, despite an abundance of medical testimony saying that indeed it was present, I think Mr. Nunnery was indeed very prejudiced by the exclusion of the testimony.
What about Consora's testimony, though, about the fetal alcohol?
I think it was compelling. I think the jury should have found it. I've raised an issue about the fact that the jury, in fact, ignored evidence over and over again and didn't find mitigators where they were clearly established. Part of that relates to the fact that we asked for a jury instruction stating that the beyond the reasonable doubt burden of proof did not apply to mitigators, as is known through the Jimenez case and through U.S. Supreme Court authority. The district court denied that instruction.
But this was a case where they found six aggravators and 11 mitigating circumstances. It's not like this was a thinking jury. I mean, it sounds like to me that they were looking at things. 11 aggravators, that's a lot of aggravators that they found. 11 mitigators.
But there were other mitigators that they didn't find, that there was no contradictory evidence. For instance, they didn't find that the father abused Nunnery as a child. That evidence was uncontradicted. Had this jury been properly instructed about the burden of proof and about the meaning of mitigation, and again, that's another issue we raise here, is they're just told that mitigation relates to moral culpability. They're never told that it's a factor against the death penalty, that it's a reason for giving a sentence less than death. Those were crucial instructions that were omitted. There's no subject upon which the mitigation acts without telling them why.
Don't you think maybe the fact that he got up and said, "Hello, jury, family, hello, I'm not sorry for what I did, I'm guilty, I'd do it again, I'm not sorry, I did that. Whether I get the death penalty or life, hey, that's what happened. Mr. Stanton dropped all the charges. I walk out of here right now and I do the same thing."
Your Honor, I have two responses to that. The first is that statement wasn't made until the selection phase of the case, long after that eligibility determination was made. So had the jury been properly instructed on eligibility, had the evidence about mitigation been presented, they would have made that decision without ever hearing that statement. The second part of my response is more complicated because this court has denied my motion for judicial notice, and I'm going to ask you to reconsider that motion because I think it is important that in two other cases, juries heard that same statement and didn't impose death. And I think given a context of fetal alcohol, given an understanding of the impulsivity, of the lack of judgment, of the lack of brain connection that we all have, we do have those brain connections, Mr. Nunnery does not, I think given a context to that outburst, they would have understood the value that it should be given. It's a man with brain damage. He's had this condition his whole life. His connections aren't being made. And I think had a jury had the proper context for that, that it wouldn't have held whatever value it may have at this trial. I'd like to just briefly note about the evidence coming in through Dana and Terrell. Those are Mr. Nunnery's younger siblings. Neither of them was alive at the time Mr. Nunnery was in utero or born. Terrell had no memory of his parents. Dana was only 12 years old. Their testimony does not substitute for the testimony of someone who was actually alive and there. On the notice of evidence in aggravation, I know, again, that the great risk aggravator was never set forth in those other notices. That whatever complexities may be going on, that's not an excuse for failing to file a notice in this case. And there were significant issues about the great risk aggravator. The fact that they alleged aiding and abetting and conspiracy and imputed liabilities, theories of liability for that aggravator. All of the other aggravators directly concern the offenses for which Mr. Nunnery had already been convicted. For the first time in the notice of evidence in the aggravation, the state's alleging that it's based upon people present at bus stops and balconies. No names are ever given. There's no opportunity for defense counsel to go out and try to find these alleged people at bus stops and balconies. It came far too late, and the notice given was inadequate, as we've already set forth in the brief. As to Mr. Betsy and the Batson issue, I would encourage the court, in the reply brief at page 6, we've set forth the other statements made by Mr. Bessie in his questionnaire, which make it very clear that he was not 100% opposed to the death penalty in all circumstances. He had stated that, yes, he could impose the death penalty where the defendant had been found guilty of killing another person, where the killing was not an accident or in self-defense. That's in his questionnaire at page 11. He stated that he was generally, when also asked about the death penalty, Mr. Bessie had stated at page 10 that he had never really thought about it. And so this is not someone who was cemented into his position on the death penalty. As to Ms. Vita, the cause challenge, certainly there's nothing in the record indicating that she was shaking, that she was having these issues. The district court did not articulate those as reasons for the cause challenge being granted. Rather, the district court said, do you know of any historical figures that should have been given the death penalty? She said no, and she was dismissed for cause. There was a brief exchange prior to that, but they submit that the exchange that happened was far too cursory and far too conflicting to justify her excusal for cause. Onto the weighing equation. Other states have found that the beyond a reasonable doubt requirement does apply. Not all of them. There's a split of authority. I believe it's Colorado and Missouri that have found, as this court did in Johnson, that the beyond a reasonable doubt requirement does apply to the weighing decision. And respectfully, this court's opinion in Johnson is directly conflicting with McConnell. In Johnson, this court says that the weighing equation is part of the eligibility determination and that that must be done beyond a reasonable doubt. In McConnell, this court says the opposite, that the weighing does not have to be done beyond a reasonable doubt. The state now is claiming that weighing is a highly subjective moral decision, not capable of being qualified in that manner. I'm okay with that so long as this court applies that uniformly and finds that it can't reweigh because it's a highly subjective and moralistic decision. It makes no sense to say that this court can make a firm conviction on weighing, but at the same time that a jury can't do so, to a beyond a reasonable doubt standard. And those two lines of cases, McConnell and the reweighing cases, are conflicting in that if it is a highly subjective moral decision, then in the event that this court finds an aggravator to be invalid, and I submit the great risk aggravator here is invalid, or finds that mitigation was improperly excluded, that this court should not conduct the reweighing analysis that it does conduct. But so long as if you're going to conduct reweighing, then I think the weighing equation has to be done to a beyond a reasonable doubt standard. Certainly, there are other cases out there, but I think what you really need to look at is the particular characteristics of Nevada's death penalty scheme that are different than the schemes of many other places. For example, in California, which I believe was the subject of the Mitchell opinion, I'm not positive, in California, the selection decision is entirely different. The scheme is different. It is not the same analysis that should be done on a Nevada case. Thank you.
Thank you. The court appreciates the arguments before today. There are a lot of issues that we've had under consideration for some time that were covered this date. We appreciate the thoughtful arguments presented to us. This case will stand submitted. All right.